Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.
And here we are for the next installment of the Culture Caucus, Bloomberg Politics podcast on the intersection of politics and culture. I'm John Heilman.
And I am Will Leach.
And you're the unprofane Will Leach.
I'm very uncomfortable by the explicit tag on our
Did you podcast. Ever have your mother threaten to wash your mouth out with soap?
There was no need. I would never give her a reason.
My mouth was washed out with soap so often that I could tell the difference between like Dawn and like other
and
brands.
And lava.
Yeah, and lava soap. I was like, oh my God, okay. It's just not the lava, Mom. Come on, not the lava. There were some soaps tasted better than others, and you know, so I had choices to make. But you know, I ate a lot of soap as a kid.
Well, I mean, I think that you deserved it, but clearly it did not work.
No, it didn't really. No, it did not work. It's true. I am still one of the most profane motherfuckers I've ever met.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Oh,
there it
my.
Is, right?
An
there.
Angel just died.
Actually, a small part of Alexander Trowbridge just died. And oh, the producers are all upset again. Oh, another Not Safe for Work podcast, Mom.
Consarn it. This is enough.
All right. So, Will, today we're going to talk about music, and not just music, but music and culture. We've been on a little bit of a sports jag lately. Some of the ladies in our audience have been a little bit like, oh, God, they're kind of slogging through the sports. So today we're going to not only talk about a topic that hopefully will not be so off-putting to some women, not all women.
I would say I know many, many
I
big
do,
sports.
I do
women.
Too. I do too. And
I've never met a guy that liked music though. And, so
yeah, that's. So one of the things, we're not only going to talk about a topic that's not going to be off-putting to some women who are sports phobic, but we're also going to talk to an actual woman who's going to be later in the show, the great and glorious, brilliant, fabulous, insightful Lizzie Goodman.
I'm very excited.
And that's going to be great. And I told Will today that we were going to have a really smart guest on the show, so he had to eat some superfood this morning to get ready for it because I didn't want him to exhibit his typical stupidity.
Yeah.
So are you...
Once I knew Lizzie Goodman was going to be on, I knew I needed to bring my A-game.
You got a good night's sleep last night?
I wouldn't go that far.
Had some acai berries this morning to get ready?
Exactly. I stopped hitting my head against things.
Fabulous. So it's been a really rough since the last time we were together, and it's been a while since I've actually
we're
seen
together.
You.
We're,
that's... First of all, that's great. You're here.
Hi.
But it's been kind of a rough spell, I'd say, over the last couple of weeks for a lot of us, having had a moment at the end of last week when the great Prince Rogers Nelson passed away. And that a lot of the topic of this podcast is going to be about that. I'm at this point already kind of starting to think of this year as music's kind of annus horribilis. If you think about all of the people who have passed away in just a few months, I mean, it's been kind of staggering, starting with David Bowie, obviously ending most recently with Prince, but in between, losing Fife Dog from Tribe Called Quest, losing Glenn Frey, losing Merle Haggard, Maurice White. That's a lot of big, I mean, any one of those people to pass away would be a big blow to music fans, but to lose all of them across so many genres, from country music to hip-hop to whatever it is that David Bowie played, which is a wide variety of eclectic musical styles, all of the kind of general genre of rock. But, you know, man, David Bowie covered a lot of musical waterfront, and so did Prince. And it got me thinking, I wanted to talk a little bit about, on this podcast, about the reaction to some of them more than others. Obviously, some had bigger cultural footprints than others, but the reactions to all of them and the ways in which the reactions have been kind of striking in the sense that they have created, to my mind, kind of moments of community and unity that are strikingly absent from the rest of our daily lives in a lot of other areas, and certainly in the area of politics, where, you know, it's a kind of a cliche to talk about how wretchedly kind of polarizing and divisive our politics are, but still true. And we are in the middle of a presidential campaign that is pushing people to extremes that are kind of almost caricatures of the way in which our political discourse and dialogue normally play out. But in this other realm, the realm of culture, we have these tragic deaths that are calling forth a degree of kind of shared mourning, grieving, expressions of love, expressions of nostalgia, expressions of, as I say, of community, that are kind of quite striking to me. And it's, again, I'll finish my preamble here in a moment, but it's, again, particularly striking to me in the context of what's going on in the cultural world, which is, you know, like everything else, fragmentation, atomization. You know, we don't have the same kind of communal experiences around culture that we once did. And yet, and maybe this is just a factor, part of the has to do with the fact that these people are come from an earlier eras. None of them were young. Prince, obviously, at 57, was the youngest of them to pass away, although that might not be true of Fife Dog. It's still the case that they come from, they hail from an earlier era. So maybe they are artifacts. Maybe we'll not have these moments going forward. But I wanted to get your thoughts, Will, just about all of that and how you've experienced in your life these passings of these people, both for you personally and in terms of how you've seen others reacting around you.
Yeah, I feel like, in my lifetime, the three biggest musical deaths were Kurt Cobain. I don't think there's any question. Kurt Cobain was, every time I'll think of Kurt Loder, and Kurt Cobain will be connected forever because of that. But that was, you got that news whenever you were around the television or wherever you happened to be near there. I feel like Michael Jackson was probably the next one. And I think that was a much larger thing. Kurt Cobain's was more, they're both tragic, but Michael Jackson was a universal figure in a similar way to the way Prince was. I think there are a lot of people that who was this young rocker that killed himself? Why did he do that? That was stupid. Whereas Michael Jackson, and I think particularly Prince, the difference I think between Michael Jackson and Prince was certainly we were online, but there was Twitter was not what it was when Michael Jackson died. And I remember when Michael Jackson died, that was a thing that a lot of people said. It's like, this is the one universal experience we have. Michael Jackson is almost this sort of relic, this idea that someone can die and the world seems to stop
right
at that moment. I think Prince is what happens when that moment happens and someone at that scale dies and everybody's online and everybody gets to Twitter. I was actually at a baseball game with my son, and I stopped paying attention to him. I think he ran out on the road. And you only wanted to be with other people that were mourning. It was more of a community thing than I think either Kurt Cobain or Michael Jackson's deaths were, because I could share it with people and I got to see all these insights and I got to see, music is something different than film or politics in the idea that everybody had a Prince moment.
Right.
Everybody had a moment in their lives where Prince touched their lives in one way or the other. And music, and I'm sure we'll talk about this with Lizzie when she gets here, music is something that hits the part of the cerebral cortex in a way that it's different than movies or politics in a lot of ways. You had a Prince moment, even if you never thought about Prince. Even if you wouldn't, even if you hadn't bought one of the funny things about Prince, of course, is he's made 30 albums over the last 5 years that most people did not even know existed.
Right.
But so it's not so much that there was this completeness everyone needed to know. It was almost like when he died, everyone was like, oh my God, I have not, Prince is such a large part of my life and I haven't thought about him as much as I should have. And I think that was kind of the shared experience that I felt like I needed to listen to people that had, what were feeling those same kind of thoughts that I was in a way that, Prince was, there was no notion that, no one thought that anything was wrong with Prince. And I think that was part of the experience too.
I think it was, so there's a lot of things to unpack there. The first is, interestingly, as you talk about Cobain, which obviously was a big deal, but they're so associated with a particular style of music, maybe unfairly, but when Cobain died, it was like he was an emblem of Generation X and of grunge.
I was in college.
Right.
That was my favorite band.
Right.
So, yes.
And a hugely influential band that mattered a lot to a lot of people, but
not Prince and not Michael Jackson.
Yes, but was kind of genre specific,
correct,
right? And also generationally specific. Yeah. And I remember actually, I thought Nirvana was a great band, but I remember feeling a little bit like almost wanting to kind of rebel against the mourning of Cobain's death because it seems so generationally cliched. The interesting thing about setting those two, Michael Jackson and Prince aside, is that it seems really important to me that they're both black, and important to me in the sense that they were massively, monstrously crossover acts, right? They were acts that were, appealing to black audiences, white audiences, and a huge, huge numbers in a way that is, again, almost inconceivable in today's culture. There's I can't think right now of someone who, of any act right now that has that kind of appeal. Now, maybe Jay-Z, maybe Beyonce, maybe. But those acts were, there have been a lot of white rock stars who are huge deals. When George Harrison died in 2001 or 2002, Cover Time magazine, a huge deal. But was most of Black America in mourning over George Harrison's death? Even African Americans who were of that generation, of the Beatles generation, George Harrison didn't mean that much. And it was not that same thing. What was interesting about this Prince thing, and Michael Jackson to some extent, was that you had this kind of cross-racial, cross-cultural kind of outpouring. That's the first thing I'd want to say. The second,
which was something that both artists actively tried to make happen.
Sure,
That's a little bit different, frankly. One of the things that's really exciting about Beyonce now is she's, in a lot of ways, she's like, this is just who I am. And there's no notion that, I'm trying to, there's actively aggressive and conflict oriented stuff that she's doing now in a way that Prince and Michael Jackson, it was very important to them, you know, to cross over as much as possible.
Right. And I think it's
in the early days of MTV when they were not really crossing over.
Totally. And I think it's actually why, if you think about these deaths just in this year, right? I mean, there are so many similarities between Bowie and Prince in terms of part of the emotional resonance of their deaths was the fact that there were so many kids of different generations who saw them as liberating in similar ways, especially along sexual lines, right? Mm-hmm. There were a lot of weirdos, and I say weirdos in the most flattering
of
sense,
course.
Right? A lot of people, kids who grew up feeling isolated, feeling strange, feeling alienated from mainstream culture, who saw Prince and saw Bowie and saw their disregard for gender norms, their disregard for sexual norms, and were like, looks at, oh, I can be weird. Yeah. It's okay to be weird.
And
right?
be enormously popular.
Yes.
And I feel like that gets lost a little bit too. It wasn't like, this is not even a conscious thing I think people were doing.
Yes.
It's just the idea that Prince is all over my television right now. This must be okay.
Right. And yet, you know, the difference between, to me, the difference in terms of volume and intensity of the reaction to their two deaths just in this year, David Bowie called forth a lot of grieving, right? But not on the scale that we saw with Prince.
It's been 5 days or 6 days and a week.
And people are
still
and, you know, someone, we're driving up here today, down here today in the cab, and Trowbridge mentioned to me that there's a party in Fort Greene Park tonight for Prince. It's like he died a week ago, right?
And Purple Rain is literally playing at multiplexes all across the country.
Yes,
right
and it's still in cars everywhere you go, and you're hearing it all over the place. And people, I believe, even maybe Lizzie Goodman came down to New York City to watch Purple Rain days after Prince had died, and you could still see it in not just multiplexes, but all over New York City. It's still still playing and people are still going to see it. So there's, I think the race thing is key, right? Because that's the biggest difference between Bowie and Prince. They're very similar, right? But again, Black America was not mourning David Bowie in the way that Black America is mourning Prince still to this day, and White America mourning Prince equally, right? Yeah. And it's because of the fact that he was an African-American artist who crossed over to such a dramatic extent. The other thing that you mentioned, which I think is really huge and that's different from the Michael Jackson death and from any of these in the past, is the existence of social media, right? That is a thing that has altered the way in which people react to these kinds of events. Yeah. And I know it's like, again, almost an obvious thing to say, but man, for those of us who live our lives to some extent on social media, the way in which grief got processed around Prince, which involved an extraordinary outpouring, and I say this as someone who was responsible for some of it, an extraordinary output of people digging through, finding tracks, finding videos, finding artifacts of Prince's output, and sharing them widely with people. I mean, I'm a pretty active Twitter user, right? But, you know, there was stuff that the reaction to things that I was posting was overwhelming, right? If you found something that was, you know, the original live recording of Purple Rain, the guy who posted that and put it up on Google Drive that I shared,
which
and many
Prince
other people
would have
shared.
Hated, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, of course. Yes,
Prince would have absolutely hated that you
but
did
he, like,
that.
But he, like, broke Google Drive.
Yeah.
It's big, right? Social media has changed that in a pretty profound way.
Which is kind of a fascinating thing, and I joked a little bit about how Prince would have hated that, but you know, one of the reasons that we had to do that is because we now listen to music over streaming, and Prince rather famously would not have any of his music done over streaming. I thought it was kind of fascinating in a lot of ways to see the number of people to be like, oh, man, I wish I could listen to some Prince right now. And like, well, you could buy it if you wanted to. You could totally buy a Prince album right now, but there, people are used to Spotify, or they're used to Pandora and just streaming that way. And so to me, I thought that was... That actually helped the process in that, like, people wanted to find all of a sudden clips like that or old YouTube. Like, I think I've seen that Prince covering Radiohead's Creep like 40,000 times since he died. Like, that's, they just became this immediate thing. And it's great. I think I watch it every time because, you know, it became like these iconic things that people wanted to send out bits of it because the thing about Prince was, you know, that he had this vast catalog that would be impossible to be like, I'm going to sit down and listen to four Prince albums, all of these Prince albums right now, because you can't. He made so much music that so much of it was easily shared in that way, that you find this time where he did this clip or the time that he was on New Girl. You know, like so much of these things became shareable in a way because he made so much music and did so many things. It was so productive and showed up in so many different ways, showing up on New Girl, covering Creep and doing, you know, and jumping in and out of genres that everybody could find their Prince clip in that time. And everybody did.
So the other thing that I think we should just talk about a little bit, and we can talk about more with Lizzie in a second, but is it just strikes me that it is, again, you line up all these musicians who have died in the last 4 months, and it is striking to me that they are musicians, right? And that, you know, I started thinking about, like, what would happen if George Clooney died? Or, I don't know, pick your favorite Hollywood movie star right now. Like, you know, who's the biggest movie star in the world?
I mean,
you know,
Denzel Washington.
Denzel Washington. Yeah. I mean, it's just, again, try to think of someone who's, I mean, little bit, you know, Tom Cruise at the peak of Tom Cruise-ness, right? You know, I don't know, pick whoever the biggest movie stars in the world are right now. Who's Will Smith, probably the most bankable African-American movie star right now. If Will Smith dropped dead tomorrow, there would be nothing like what we saw around Prince or around Bowie, or frankly, I think probably like what we saw around Fife Dog, who was the second most important part of a hip hop band that I love deeply, but that is not like a cultural cornerstone or touchstone for as many people as either Prince or David Bowie. But I mean, what would happen if Will Smith died tomorrow? I mean, again, all respect to Will Smith. He's a huge economic force in the movie industry. He's a huge star. Mm-hmm. He has huge glamour. He has many, many millions of fans. But would there be an outpouring of national grief like there was for Prince? No, I don't think so. It would be like a, you know, an interesting story for a couple days. But not like this, not like with people in tears, not with like Will Smith marathons now on whatever channel you want to say on television.
The idea that people are paying $12 to go watch Purple Rain in a theater all across the country right now is pretty astounding.
So, but it's amazing. So what is that, do you think? I mean, what is it about music that creates stars who, again, if you think about the economic weight of Will Smith versus Prince, you know, what's Will Smith's estate worth versus Prince's estate? I don't know. Will Smith's probably worth close to $1 billion. He's probably worth more than Prince was. And yet Prince, obviously, in cultural weight, cultural value, is much, much higher. So what is it about music that, you know, the music industry is much more under siege? Like, the story of the last decade has been industry, you know, because of streaming, because of downloads, because of all the technological changes that have affected the industry, people think of the music industry as more besieged than we think of the television business or the movie business as being, right? It's a less healthy, in some ways economically, a less healthy industry than other parts of the culture industry. And yet, again, the resonance of these musicians, and again, at least the ones that we're talking about today, is much, much greater. So why is that, do you think?
I think there's just an emotional connection to music that isn't there. Like, Will Smith will make a bad movie, and you can be like, I don't like that Will Smith. Like, I remember how bad he was in that movie, and it sticks with you. Music is different. Music is something that is ingrained into your life in a way that not only do you connect it to different times, you connect it to different activities. The idea that, like, particularly now in a world where music is instantly available to you at all times, I've listened to Prince while doing the dishes. I've listened to Prince in concert. I've listened to Prince while driving my car. Theoretically, people have probably listened to Prince while doing fornicating things. I'm not familiar with any of those, but I'm
theoretically,
sure. Theoretically speaking.
Theoretically. Fornicating things? I think you mean f***ing, Will, is I think what you mean.
Another angel died. But the point is that, like, music is it's something that you don't even think about it until it's taken you over in a lot of ways. And music is something that you can experience however you want to. When it comes to music, you can have whatever you want from it. And I think everybody had something from Prince.
Well, and I think also there's the ways in which we consume these products, right? It is the question of a movie is a discrete thing. There are cinemaphiles who are constantly watching clips of films and absorbing them. But basically, you know, for most normal people, a movie is a discrete object of somewhere between 90 minutes and 120 minutes.
It's something
minutes
you do alone.
That you go, or you do it with someone, but
it's
you
a
go
solitary
and
experience.
You watch the movie and then you've done it. Maybe you'll watch the movie 100 times. Right. You're a Star Wars nut, you watch it 100 times. But music is everywhere, right? It's ambient and it can be consumed in small chunks, in large chunks, in virtually any setting, virtually anywhere. It goes with you everywhere. It's totally portable. And it is, for that reason, more all-enveloping and all-encompassing, right? And it creates that soundtrack of your life kind of quality that, for a lot of people, they have very, very vivid, distinct memories of other things they were doing while listening to music, as opposed to watching a movie, which is basically a discrete act that you go and take part in. You watch the movie, you're done, you go on. You think about it, the movie lives in your memory, but it doesn't live in your consciousness at all times.
I have danced to Let's Go Crazy at multiple weddings.
Yes.
Like, it's just like, if it
I would not want to see that.
Oh, it's pretty great.
You're a very white man.
Okay, I've basically just like jumped up and down against the wall a little bit.
You're like okay, good. I was going to say, you're like, I can't imagine that you have rhythm. Do you have rhythm?
Yes, as long as there are no follow-up questions.
So here's my last question, and then we can talk to Lizzie, who I think probably is about to arrive. I sense her presence. She's like...
There is a disruptant.
She's looming somewhere nearby. My last question for you, thank God, there are still a lot of great musical acts, some who've been making music for a long time, some who've been making music for a shorter period of time, but there's no doubt that the audiences for music are atomized and fragmented. Like, again, the audiences for all cultural products are now. Do you imagine that there will be apart from those acts who obtained greatness and hugeness in past eras, yeah. You know, will there be moments like this? Are we making musical acts today who will have moments like the Prince moment when they pass away 40 years from now or 50 years from now? Or is this thing of mass kind of communal grieving that we're now having for acts that were big when media was less fragmented? Are these a dwindling number of these that we will not, that the future generations will not have these moments?
I think we're making those musicians. I just don't think we're all collectively listening to them. And as one is probably the best way to think about it. Like the idea that right now, if you like a certain type of music, you can just listen to that. Like that, we are a niche world in a lot of ways now, and everyone can find out. It's not really a goal even in a lot of ways for. Like one of the things with Michael Jackson and Prince is they really wanted to become the biggest pop star in the world. It was very important. Their rivalry, and that was something that was very important to them. Not that people don't want to do that now, but it's not really an achievable goal in the way that, like, if Michael Jackson and Prince were on MTV and on every radio, they were everywhere. There was nowhere else. There was nowhere else coming in. There are so many channels now that I'm not sure, and even if a Prince or Michael Jackson came along now, that we, and they're probably out there, I'm just not listening to them, or someone else, we're not all listening to them together. I think it's really hard to hit every quadrant in a way, because there are now a million quadrants rather than the fewer than there were before.
Right, kind of depressing, actually. But I'm going to put that aside for the moment and bring this portion of the podcast to a close. This is Culture Caucus, Bloomberg Politics podcast with me and...
Will Leach, I think.
Yeah, he's a good man. Very white, as I pointed out before, but still acceptable in many ways because he's, you know, a really nice guy.
Thanks.
Hey, Will, where can you hear this podcast?
You can hear this podcast. Of course, we encourage everyone to subscribe to us on iTunes. And while you're there, please give us a nice review. It helps people find the podcast and it makes us feel good and as if we have someone with us in this crazy, lonely drive through this dying planet. Also, you can find us on SoundCloud. And on BloombergPolitics.com.
Will just went really dark there for a second. That was a little weird.
Sometimes I get alone.
Okay, so let's take a break.
I apologize for nothing.
Let's take a break and come back. And wait. I hear footsteps. The gentle.
She's right behind you.
The gentle, delicate footsteps of Lizzie Goodman. I hear them. Let's take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.
And we're back with the latest installment of the Culture Caucus. I'm John Heilman.
And I believe, am Will Leach.
And we're here talking about 2016 as music's annus horribilis. I love using Latin.
Mm-hmm. That was Latin?
That's Latin. Okay. Latinate. That's Latinate. And we have with us now the great Lizzie Goodman. Hi, Lizzie.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
So I was thinking about...
This is awesome. I think Lizzie Goodman is awesome. So I'm very excited to have her.
Already? Okay. That's all it took?
No. Your existence did not like suddenly become aware to me today.
Yeah. Lizzie is excellent in every way, and Will professes to be a great fan of her work, as I am. But here's the thing. About Lizzie Goodman. You have a complicated resume, right? It's really hard to like say, here's Lizzie Goodman and here's, you know, what she does. So I want you to just tell, for the sake of our audience who are not as familiar with your work as we are, you are an authority on rock music because...
I don't know if I would say I'm an authority.
I'm
an authority on maybe music culture.
Okay.
Which I do think is a different thing. And I learned the difference from working at lots of music magazines where there are lots of authorities on actual music. I write my background is music journalism. That's kind of how I got my start. Spin, Rolling Stone, Blender, NME. And then I started writing about culture and music for more general interest publications like New York Magazine and other places. And now I cover a lot of the same stuff, culture in general, for Elle and other places. And I'm working on a book about music in New York from 2001 to 2011.
And that's an oral history, I believe.
It's an oral history, and Mr. John Heilman is a participant in the oral history. So.
But it's like a 10,000-page book, right? That's the thing. It's like.
Okay, gotta go.
Why are you wasting time with us?
What's that?
I've cut it down.
Right from 100,000 pages.
It got
to
a little
50.
Unwieldy. Okay. Yeah. You know, when you're writing, when you're sculpting other people's words as your material, yeah. You know, and they're all so smart and brilliant and have such interesting things to say.
Also John.
And then John's in there. I mean, John really helped me, you know, cut things down, actually, because once I know, it's a lot. But yeah, it is shorter. It will eventually be finished. And hopefully it'll be riveting and sound like a good cocktail party. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's kind of what it's about.
Is there a title for that book?
It's called Meet Me in the Bathroom.
It's very subtle.
It's very safe for work.
It's a good title.
What's a stroke song?
It's a stroke song.
I know.
Yes, it is. But you know, it's also, I feel like it'll get the message across to those who do not know that it's a stroke song as well. Right.
It is the case you also write for the New York Times Magazine occasionally.
I do, yes.
It's always good to
There's lots of places.
It's always good to invoke the New York Times because it gives some fleeting sense of authority to this podcast. Where
failing paper
I
said.
I have written many music features for the New York Times Magazine.
Right. Will Leach actually has written one story for the New York Times?
I've written several stories for the New York Times.
I wasn't trying to be demeaning. I was just trying to point. You were very excited.
What's your favorite?
Of all of them?
Yeah, that you've done.
So many. Who can? It's like choosing among my sad two-dimensional children.
Wow.
Not my actual children. They have three dimensions and are able to move around the world
and
interact with them. I just mean the paper.
Okay.
So let's go to the topic here. Although I do enjoy banter. It is the case, it should be noted as a historical fact, that the person that I learned that Prince died from was Lizzie Goodman.
That's true.
Who texted me about it. I was in the middle of a lunch, and it seemed totally implausible to me that it could be true. And yet it was. So Lizzie, were you surprised at the extent and depth and passion and emotionalism of the outpouring that Prince's death provoked in our culture?
It's funny, maybe it's evidence of a sort of answer to that I hadn't thought about it until right now, whether I thought that was surprising or not, because I've been so busy participating in it. I live upstate now, and I was driving up the other day and just coming back after a time in the city, and they are showing Purple Rain at the Rosendale Theater in a town that has like a cheese store and a cafe and like one restaurant that serves two dishes. And they're like, okay, well, we're obviously going to have to have Purple Rain around here too. I mean, it's that kind of all encompassing, and it does feel like a kind of communal church experience of some kind. And I guess I'm not surprised, but I haven't thought enough about it to know whether I think it's surprising. I think in keeping with some of what you were saying earlier, one of the differences between Prince and Bowie, in addition to all the sort of actual musical differences, et cetera, they have a lot in common. But is that the commercial weight of Prince in America was huge on a level that Bowie never quite reached. So there's also that. I mean, I think that Bowie sort of managed to popularize, even in his greatest heights, a more resonant commitment to oddness maybe than Prince did. And so there is, even though Prince is, I think that's one of Prince's highest achievements, is being so weird and so huge at exactly the same time. It probably is surprising, but it's also such a pleasure to see that anyone care, that we all care this much about something, especially given the broader context politically and otherwise, also pop culturally. I mean, I think that for a variety of reasons that are worth getting into, but you know, aren't really relevant to this specific question. There aren't artists that are able to command this kind of emotional connection and be this big, at least right now. Maybe there will be, maybe they aren't. they haven't died yet, so we don't know. But, you know, I don't think that that's something that you see a lot of right this minute in an obvious way.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about Bowie is that in so many incarnations, he had so many incarnations, right? And he was in so many instances playing a part, very explicitly playing a part, you know, whether it was Ziggy Stardust or the Thin White Duke or whatever, that the theatrical element of who was David Bowie is a question still to this day. You've like asked that question, who was David Bowie? Clearly odd and clearly had a complicated relationship to gender identity and to sex and sexuality and sexual expression. And that's part of, again, why I think for a lot of kids who are alienated or confused or whatever when they're growing up, why he was a potent symbol. And yet his oddness took different forms and felt consciously put on in various ways, right? Again, playing roles that were designed and created and meant to express a certain thing. Prince's oddness feels more organic, right? Because there were not various iterations of Prince. He was the same weirdo from start to finish. And again, I say those things as in terms of, I say those as terms of not of approbation, but yes, I mean they're yes, but there were not multiple princes, right? He didn't go through those kinds of phases, and I think there's a difference there. And so the thing you're talking about the oddness of him feels like Prince was always Prince, and yet he still was able to be huge in that way. Again, Michael Jackson was a pretty weird guy too.
Yeah.
I will just say I was surprised in the sense that I think when Michael Jackson died, it did not surprise me at all that every cable network was like threw all news out for some period of time, you know, for hours where it was just Michael Jackson. They just canceled all of the news programming and talked about nothing but Michael Jackson for, again, a day and a half, whatever it was. When the Prince thing happened, I got to work and I was a little surprised that every cable network had gone to just Prince and that it stayed like that for many, many hours. I don't know that I was right to be surprised, but I was surprised that was the case. As you monitored your social media and your friends emailing you things and texting you things, et cetera, what stood out to you?
It's weird. I mean, I was literally on the phone with a friend who saw Prince's last concert when he got a text from his girlfriend saying that we should check the news. Like, I was doing it following up an interview with him for the book, and he had just seen him. And so I sort of, in this bizarre real-time speakerphone moment, we both had this, no, that can't be right. What? Wait, hold on. And started Googling at the same time, but stayed on the phone with each other. And I think, you guys talked a little bit about some of the things that come to mind, but community being a big one. I mean, there is just, and I guess it's fueled, the capacity to succeed in sharing all of this is fueled by social media, but I think the instinct is, you know, era neutral. Like, you want to talk to other people. You want to send stuff to other people. You want them to feel something when they watch what you've just watched and felt something about. And I think that connects to the larger thing that makes music different from everything else in culture, which is, you talked about it a bit, it's the emotional resonance, but it's also like the biographical tie-in. I mean, you're not Prince, Bowie, etc. These are people who really, our affection for pop stars is a kind of affection for ourselves, right? It's like these people mark specific times in my life, and the accepted relationship that they've signed on for is to do exactly that. Like, there's nothing manipulative about that. It's like they're going to it's the job. They're going to make something. It's their job to go and be the most complete self-actualized version of themselves with all these evident gifts that nobody else really has. And then the exchange is that we will like pay them with love and affection and money to be able to kind of use them as instructive models in certain points, as role models and as kind of narrators of our own lives. So I think that's the thing that struck me the most is people feeling you'd send somebody a clip or you'd put something out on Twitter and then you'd get, oh my God, I was at that show. Or, oh my God, I remember I got, you know, side conversations with friends about experiences that we had with Prince's music or with specific shows that also then would have to take place on Twitter and then you'd send it to somebody else. And then I had one friend who discovered that the guy she was dating doesn't like Prince, and that caused a lot of problems. I mean, it's sort of this like,
yeah. He should be quiet, by the way.
Yeah,
for a while.
I didn't know what to say. I agreed that it was a pretty strong deal breaker, but you know, there's it's immediately personal. And it immediately, it's almost like an immediate sort of retrospective on your own life that's called up. And that's what's different about musicians from everything else. The only other thing that I think compares is potentially, it's funny given the beginning of your conversation, but sports stars. It's because of the fact that you follow them over a long period of time. Right. And I think it's because of the fact that what they're excellent at, like the thing that earns them the right to be a name we know in the first place, as opposed to a movie star or a politician or all these other people, is something that belongs exclusively to them. It's their skill, and that's understood. You know, a politician's job in some way is to at least tip the hat to radiating the will of the people, or to kind of like being, they're supposed to at least pretend that they care what you think and what, you know, even if the you is the masses. Not pop stars. Like, they're supposed to come show up and kind of tell us how to be awesome. And we're like, all right, yeah, that's okay. If we agree that that's a good way to be awesome, then you win, you know?
I'm kind of curious. It's funny, John, you talked about how all the cable channels just decided that there was no news and that they were all going to do Friends. I think that's really fascinating.
Here's the striking thing. They shut off Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's how you knew.
That's like, how big is Prince's death? Yeah. So big that he preempted Trump.
Yeah. It's really amazing. That's amazing.
And it's kind of wild, too, because I feel like that's also a little bit of our Media Now story, too, in the idea that the reason that that every site, no matter what you covered, had a Prince story. Here's what how athletes are reacting to Prince's death.
Totally.
How movie stars are, and I feel like that is part, it started to become very beneficial for cable networks and for websites to talk about Prince as much as possible, regardless of the context.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons that this has pushed this period of mourning in a longer than, say, Michael Jackson's was. Like, we were all very shocked by Michael Jackson, but like a couple days later, once we were figuring out what had happened, this has become a thing where everybody's got a Prince take, because everybody's got a Prince story. And do you think that's something that's just, is that a unique musician thing? Is there something that Prince, in a way, because one of the things I find fascinating about Prince is he was such a specific person in a specific way, pretty consistently for 30 years or 40 years, however long, but he meant so many different things to so many different people.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the question of whether it's specific to musicians, I think, is the one we're already sort of circling around. And I think so, but, you know, let's see who else dies.
Yeah,
and we'll find
out. Let's start taking some people out.
I don't, all right. This is such a weirdly subtextually morose conversation.
Yeah.
But,
all right, Michael Jordan. How are you feeling?
Exactly. But I think I do think he's unique among musicians that way, though, because even Michael Jackson, I was sort of, you know, in anticipation of coming here, trying to think a little bit about, in addition, I mean, and also because my books do, and also because all I've done for a week is think about Prince, like, it really fit in with what I was already doing. But I was trying to think about kind of what makes him unique, even among the class of elite artists who've shaped our culture and who everyone has these private relationships with. And one of them is the depth of his kind of his reach in all different aspects of music. I mean, even Michael Jackson had, like, Quincy Jones. Madonna is certainly a good example. I mean, Madonna's reach is Madonna's brilliance and what she's iconic for is in part about kind of forecasting a kind of fame that requires taste in other people's gifts. So she put the Beastie Boys on tour. She finds the best producers. Madonna's gift has been in part about being like, you, this fashion designer, this photographer, so on and so forth.
But Beyonce's gifts too, I think.
Totally. Yeah. Oh my God, absolutely. Yeah, that's been, I think, successfully and rightly pointed out a lot about her. She just sees what will work on her, kind of. And that's not a like less interesting skill. Right. That's an incredibly important skill, especially in this day and age with all the different sort of the visual medium, all the things
like
we've already been talking about.
It's like some weird combination of taste, curatorial acuteness, and forecasting, and like social, being able to read the social and cultural landscape and combining that with a sense of aesthetics and this curatorial thing. It's a kind of miraculous kind of set of skills.
And the confidence to embody that, to be like, I am the person you need to help elevate, which is a thing. Like, that's an important thing. And so Prince didn't do, I mean, he was really old school in that way. It's like the guy, in fact, the opposite was true. It's like, I was thinking a lot about how he's almost in a way, something that you're seeing a lot of kind of the younger millennial artists do now, which is like building samples for themselves, backing themselves up vocally on their own records, kind of inventing production names so that they can produce their own records without people necessarily understanding that it's them producing their own records. Like he did, not only was he Prince, he was also the guy behind, the kind of Svengali behind all these other bands. And that, to answer your ultimate question, I mean, I think that's part of the specific, unique to him look at how he's being mourned. Is that all the people who are coming out of the woodwork with these specific stories are coming from a lot of different genres and spaces within music.
One thing that I find interesting, too, about the Prince thing is Prince was almost his own, like, all of Prince's collaborators were not so much this, you know, you talked about the Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones. It was Prince and then a bunch of other people who were Prince people.
Totally.
And I think that's kind of a fascinating thing about it, too. I'm curious your thoughts about how that shaped his music and how, you know, whether it was The Revolution or Sheena E. or Vanity, like it felt like there were all of these people. Prince walked into a room and when he left, everybody followed him.
Yeah, I know. I think that this is something that's been pointed out about his, I mean, he was a posse guy. Like he built his own posse and kind of before that was necessarily something that a lot of people certainly in a pop space were doing. Like he would kind of scout that talent and then figure out how that talent could be best used for him, but then also empower that talent to go and populate their own space in whatever particular way they wanted, and then he would support that. So it's sort of, I mean, again, it's like 100 different hats the guy was wearing, and I do think that helps explain why he's being mourned in this specific and multi-layered way.
So let me ask you this question as we wind this thing up. You mentioned this, you used the word political earlier in some context, and someone in the 24 hours after Prince died, might have been Anil Dash, said this thing about how Prince was a resolutely political artist. Mm. And I called him on the phone and we got in a long conversation about what he meant by that, because he was talking about control. His argument was that Prince was focused on control in a really profound way in terms of how he ran his life, ran his business, the fight that he had with Warner Brothers, getting back control of his masters, the fights that he had with streaming services, all that stuff was basically a really profoundly political, radical political, these were radically political fights and stances that he took that were all about seen in the context of how so many African-American artists had been abused by the record industry for so long that his acts were a rebellion against that, and they took place in this particular historical context, and that he was fighting against that and asserting control. And he asserted control throughout a variety of other ways too, right? I mean, not just in terms of his commercial arrangements, but his musical arrangements, the ways in which he presented himself to the public. All of these things were essentially about self-determination in some deep way, and that was a political, not in the partisan political sense, but in the small p political sense. When you think about Prince, do you think about Prince as being a political act?
I do now that you said that. I mean, I hadn't in that space. I mean, sure, like, if you know even a little bit about Prince, you understand the sort of context of white Minneapolis and, like, the scene that he came out of. You know, just the basic sort of, like, bad biopic version would be like, that can't have been easy, you know? And I think that's kind of an awareness that I had when thinking about him before was sort of in the racial space of just, but also, I mean, this is part of what I think is brilliant about him. And weirdly, he's gone, but I don't think the culture is really caught up to actually where he belonged yet. Like maybe in 50 years, we'll be in like the kind of where he actually was in terms of the sort of genre blending, like label-less, fully actualized, varied artist that he was. But I would have thought of him as kind of shape-shifting through that kind of categorization, because what space was, but so I would have thought of him as sort of not particularly political because he was doing so many things at once. But another way of thinking about it, given what you just said, I mean, that is all totally true. So there's no arguing with that kind of look. But now that I'm thinking about it, maybe the other way to think about it is that he's political in every space. I mean, it's like if you're talking about a person who is essentially a member of an oppressed community, any oppressed community you can think of, he on some level would have been a member of that community, right. whether you're talking about gender, you're talking about, you know, musicians' rights, you're talking about poverty, you're talking about being a child of abuse, you're talking about being a Black person, you're talking about being a Black African-American man. I mean, and the oppression of musicians, but the oppression specifically of Black musicians, is one of many ways you could look at him, certainly as a revolutionary. And why not call him a political revolutionary while you're at it?
Yeah. I got to say, it's like one of the things that I've been thinking about this a lot over the last week or so. I think one of the things that really struck me, so much of how culture processes the passings of various important people has to do with the generational questions of, like, who's running the media now, you know, and who has a big voice. You know, there was a time when baby boomers were the dominant forces in our media world. And so the things that mattered to them were, you know, things that revolved around acts from the 1960s, right? Mm-hmm. You know, for me, again, I think I'm a stand-in here for, you know, as a 50-year-old guy who is now has a lot of his cohorts having a lot of say in what goes on in cable television or in print or other places digitally. You know, the fact that Prince was his dominant artistic output and culture shaping artistic output was from roughly 1980 to roughly 1992-ish. You know, you could play with those dates a little bit, but they coincide basically with my time and my generation's time as a high school freshman to ending graduate school, right? Mm-hmm. The period from age like 15 to age like, you know, 25, which is for most people the period in which music is, they're absorbing the most music, it's most important to their lives, they hear the most, they're most open to different kinds of styles, they're most open to different kinds of music, they play music constantly. Again, some of us continue to do that, but many other people don't, right? And yeah. So that period when music matters most, Prince mattered most. And for a huge number of people who have, as I say, a large, maybe outsized say in what gets talked about in media right now, they had the same experience that I had, which was, man, you know, Madonna, Prince, U2, REM, like those were epic, giant, huge forces in that particular time frame, 1980 to like from the, like the late 70s, early 80s to like the early 90s. Again, some of them made music for many years after that. But in that period, they were most fecund and they were also most influential to a particular cohort of people who, like, as I say, have big megaphones right now in terms of how you talk about things. And I think that's at least part of what's going on. Doesn't explain anything like the totality of the Prince reaction, but it does explain part of it, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if everyone who lost their virginity to your music is now in charge of a network TV station, like, that's going to help you get some coverage if right. you die. But it doesn't, I mean, I went on iTunes, not again, you know, you can't stream his music, so everyone's kind of doing this interesting battle, which he might hate, to find free ways to listen to all this stuff and participate in this catharsis. But I did go on iTunes in the couple of days after he died, and all of the searches were for variations on the Prince theme.
Right.
And whether that's, you know, is the media creating a environment where people who know why they should care about this person and actually do care about this person are then inadvertently introducing people who maybe don't to the fact that they should, and then that's fueling this, maybe. I mean, I'm sure there's part of that. But, you know, most people who are 25 who are figuring out to go and dig up whatever clip is temporarily being hosted on whatever site are not also watching CNN all day long. So I don't think it's that. I don't think it's feeding itself on that level. I think there genuinely is. It is the sort of omnipotence of this morning is a testament to his generational reach, in addition to the fact that, like, a lot of people of your specific generation are really sad.
All right. I've never said this before in the long, like, epic length history of this podcast, which stretches back all the way to January. But I've never said to a guest who's been on this podcast before that we're going to have them back, because you're great, Lizzie Goodman.
Thank you. I'd love to come back.
You're a great talker and a really smart person. And you talk smartly and interestingly about things that I really am interested in. So you'll come back.
Okay.
We'll have
great
you back
talker.
Soon.
I like that.
Maybe not next week, but like soon. Will is so staggered by your brilliance that he has passed out. He passed out. He's on the floor in a heap, laying here on the ground, and thereby, and therefore incapable of bringing this podcast to a close. So I'm going to have to do it on my own, which, you know, God, I hate to hear the sound of my own voice. So as everyone knows. So I'll go solo here and just say thank you, Lizzie Goodman, for doing this. Will, when you revive and get yourself up off the floor, I'll see you here next time for the next installment of Culture Caucus. This installment now coming to an end. Please, if you are hearing this now, don't forget where you heard it, likely on iTunes or maybe at the website for BloombergPolitics.com. Say nice things for us at the on the reviews, because that matters to somebody. And certainly the fact that you enjoy this, if you do enjoy this, matters to us. And so we like to hear from you, and please express that to make us feel happy in this time of great sadness. So I'm John Heilman, and he's Will Leach on the floor, and that's Lizzie Goodman waving, and I think now trying to maybe revive Will with some smelling salts. So that's all for now, and we'll see you next time on the Culture Caucus.
Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.